from the top.
Welcome to the Herd Podcast, brought to you by Elephant Run District, an independent theater company in New York City. Our play, recorded February 18th, 2016, is Zelda and Scott by Bethy Fowler. Bethy is a playwright who, fun fact, starred in a children's television series in Ireland. This is an unabridged presentation of an original work by Bethy Fowler and cannot be copied, rebroadcast, or otherwise presented without the playwright's permission. More information about Bethy's plays and the other wonderful things she does can be found at bethyfowler.com. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you feel inspired to donate to support our company and the spirit of independent theater that we represent, please go to our website, elephantrundistrict.org, and click on the donate button. Links to our website with all of the fun stuff we're doing and to bethyfowler.com can be found on the bottom of this page as well. Check them out. This play features Mia Jessup, Edward Bauer, with stage directions read by Bethy Fowler and directed by Mark Atkinson. And now, please enjoy Zelda and Scott by Bethy Fowler.
One. Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald was born in Minnesota in 1896. Zelda Sayre was born in 1900 in Alabama. They meet for the first time in a Montgomery Country Club ballroom in July of 1918, while Scott is in town for his military service during World War I. To his disappointment, the war ended before Scott saw action.
Hello.
Excuse me?
You hadn't asked, but I wanted to introduce myself. You're the most popular girl in the room. I was watching you, I saw you dancing.
Oh. Hello there. Have you seen a fellow in an army uniform? I'm looking for him.
Oh, yeah, you mean me?
What? Oh, there he is. Hello, I'm coming.
I see you're busy.
Oh, these things are always hectic.
May I have this waltz?
You'll have to wait your turn.
But...
I like your yellow boots. Excuse me.
She dances away. Scott chases after.
Excuse me, may I cut in? Thanks ever so. I'm not good at waiting.
That was abrupt. I like you. You're who?
I'm not from here. I just arrived here. The army base. You know, it's all very strange.
Oh, here's Dan. And... Excuse me, I owe him a dance.
She dances away again.
Hang on, come back. Cutting in, thank you. Miss, I'm sorry, but...
You again?
I want to talk to you.
So talk.
You look like a flower. Like an exotic thing, a poppy, or a...
Flowers are awful, aren't they? They're lovely, and then they die.
I didn't mean...
All right, Cloud. That's all right and good. Excuse me, this is John cutting in on you.
Who said I was Cloud? No, sir, you may not cut in. It's impossible to get a word in with all these fellows flocking around you.
He holds her closer.
And what word would that be, Jacques?
No.
Don't shout at the pretty girl. Is that the only word you wanted to say?
I'm sorry, I'm not Jacques. That's not my name. And I'm not Cloud either. I'm not French at all. I'm from Minnesota. We're not French up there.
You've got something French about you, I'm sure.
Will you go out with me? After this, I mean.
Aren't you a fast worker, Mr.
Fitzgerald, but will you?
Well, I never make late dates with fast workers. Excuse me, I see my beau.
Who's your beau?
Peyton. Well, or John. I can't recall which one exactly.
You're a terribly neglectful girl.
They don't seem to mind.
What about tomorrow for a date?
I'm otherwise engaged tomorrow. But you may call me.
Tomorrow?
Or sometime. Though Daddy don't like late callers. Now... If you'll excuse me, whichever my beau is promised me a ride home, so I'd better find him. I wouldn't want to appear neglectful.
Two. Throughout their courtship, Zelda and Scott wrote to each other frequently. Scott preserved all of Zelda's letters to him, but she either lost or destroyed his, so we can only extrapolate from her replies what they might have said. This is February 1919. Zelda is in her bedroom in Alabama, holding an envelope containing a few small abortifacient pills. She is speaking to her sister, Rosalind.
Scott thinks I'm a whore. He really does. Tootsie, it's just the most awful thing anyone's ever done. Look what he sent me. Look at these. He thinks that I'm a whore. How dare he send me this poison like I'm some New York hussy? Maybe his girls in New York will just get rid of the baby and move on, but I'm a sayer. We're sayers, Tootsie, and that's supposed to mean something. And don't you tell me it's my own damn fault, because it was his idea. And he'll just have to marry me. That's what? I'm no whore who will take some pills and pretend it never happened. He's the one who's Catholic. I don't want to hear a word of advice from you either, Tootsie. I know you're too wonderful to ever go with a little weasel like Scott. You'll never have to face this kind of dishonor. You're all washed up already. If he thinks he's got himself a complacent little whore down in Alabama, he can think again. He's asking me to sacrifice my self-respect for him. I'd never. Listen, he was probably going to marry me anyhow. If he tries to get out of it, he can go straight to hell. I'll write to him. It'll come out all right. We're probably getting married anyhow.
3. After several breakups and reconciliations, Scott made his engagement to Zelda official after the successful publishing of his first novel, This Side of Paradise. He gave her a platinum wristwatch engraved from Scott to Zelda. In 1927, Zelda threw it out of the window of a moving train. This is before all of that, in August 1919. Scott sits on a stone bench in the Montgomery Cemetery.
And that one marks a soldier's grave, too. A Confederate soldier, of course.
Of course.
This one's a relative of mine, great aunt. I think she died of pneumonia. We're all delicate, except Daddy and me. The most interesting ones are the Confederate soldiers. When I was little, I used to break my heart over these tragic fallen soldiers' graves, but now I think they're romantic. They died a noble death, and now pretty young girls come and fascinate over them. That's not so bad. I wouldn't mind that kind of passing myself. Are you bored yet?
Never. I could listen to you talk forever. Your voice is so memorable.
You're awfully romantic, you know.
Oh, I'm afraid I must seem rather feminine to you compared with your southern gents. I am rather feminine. I've always had more girlfriends than boys. I understand girls. I can talk with them. Their rituals make sense to me. With men, there's some kind of unspoken code I can't quite grasp. If I see a man I admire, I can't talk with him. I can only copy him, sort of try to emulate him. All my life I've been easier with girls. I'm easier with my mother, too.
I'm the opposite. Or the same, I guess. I get along better with boys.
Well, that's because half of Montgomery is madly in love with you. It's not hard to get along with people who love you. Is it true that an airman crashed his plane after you broke off your engagement?
Nearly.
Come and sit with me and make me believe for a few minutes that I'm your favorite person in the wide world.
For a few minutes you might be.
You're amazing. It's like I've finally found the rest of myself. All those years in school, even when I got to Princeton, I was wandering around, lost. I thought I was a writer, but I hadn't found my muse. I was a nothing. And I will be again if you ever give me up. How does that feel, to be able to make or break a man?
I couldn't say.
You understand me, and I understand you. Like we've known each other since ancient times. You're the only other interesting person in the world.
We weren't engaged, really, only he thought we were.
Why?
Because I kissed him, and he's old-fashioned. He was devastated that I didn't want to marry him, just... he was so staid, and he smelled like fading geraniums.
So why did you kiss him?
I'd never kissed a man with a mustache before.
You must stop seeing other men. You're going to marry me, aren't you? Even though you don't have to, even though there's no baby after all.
I'll marry you. Probably.
I see why they always keep princesses locked away in towers. I wish I could make you love me as much as I love you.
You know I love only you. You're my Dodo and I'll be your wife. I will. So what if I go out now and then? There's nothing else to do around here. I want to be married already, but you know we can't afford it yet.
You promise?
Yes.
She kisses him.
Oh, darling, Here is my heart.
They kiss again. He pulls away.
What's wrong?
What's wrong with you?
Nothing. Nothing.
They kiss. 4. Although Scott and Zelda married in a Catholic church, it's doubtful either one was a virgin on their wedding night. It's also doubtful that they lost their virginity to each other. Here are Scott and Zelda waiting in the tiny chapel off St. Paul's Cathedral in New York, April 1920.
She's late.
She's not, though. We're early.
We don't have all day.
She's on the train. What's wrong?
Which train? She won't make it in time.
In time for what? What are you saying?
We have to start. We must. It's not her wedding. Why should she decide the time?
Keep your voice down. I don't want Rosalind and Newman to hear.
Why? They should be upset about this as we are. She's their sister, too.
I'm not upset.
Don't you want to get married?
Of course I do.
If we can't do it right now, we might as well not do it.
Well, we will. We're here. Here we are. What's the panic?
I've never been married before. Where's Ludlow?
Nor have I, for heaven's sake. There's no need to asphyxiate ourselves with worry. Tildy's coming. Then she'll be here, then we'll be married and drink champagne and live happily ever after.
Where's Ludlow? I need the best man.
He's just yonder with the priest, the father thing.
I'm telling him to start.
Don't you dare.
I'm the groom. I'm deciding.
10 minutes.
Now or never.
No.
Never?
10 minutes, please.
Better make it now. I can't stand to wait any longer. Can you? How can you bear being in between? What if something happens? Don't you want to be married? It'll be for the rest of our lives. Have you thought of that?
Yes, of course I have. Isn't that what it's for?
I'm sorry, Zelda. I can't wait another minute. I can't.
Please. For my sister. For me.
He goes off stage for the priest.
Father, we're ready for you. Father, come and marry us now. Please.
5. Once they married, the Fitzgeralds took up residence in New York City, where they fell in with the literary crowd at the Algonquin Round Table. They spent lavishly and drank heavily. This is August 1920, the Biltmore Hotel, where they lived until they were evicted after one too many parties. Scott holds 2 cocktails. Zelda stands in the doorway of the bathroom.
That was awful. I don't know what I was thinking.
She sinks to the floor.
You were just tipsy. They hardly noticed. Not like the other night. That was perhaps worth lying down about.
You were terrible, not me. I'm so ashamed of you flirting with everybody like that. We're supposed to be married, Scott. You're a drunk. I'm going to call you Scotch from now on.
Oh, get up.
No. I might as well live here now. I'll be the floor girl of the Biltmore, and people can come and gawk at me, and they'll whisper to each other, "That was once a delicate woman who moved up to New York City, and now she's Mrs. Nobody of the Floor, the poor thing."
Come out of that. I've got a way to lift your spirits and calm your nerves all at once. Spirits for the spirit.
Thank you kindly, Scotch, but Our Lady of St. Floor won't be partaking in your uncouth libations. No, sir, not at this time, nor at a later time, for she must vehemently reject all distraction as she pioneers a life for herself here in the dust-speckled world of Floor.
Is there really dust? That's disgraceful.
I'm sure it's mine. I'm the opposite of housekeeping.
Won't you get up and play nice with me? We were having a fine time. What happened?
I fell for you and I cannot arise.
Come to the window. Look at the lights. Everything is shining for us.
I don't want to look. I can't ever get used to living here. Too many people all rushing by like we don't even see them from up here. Every single one of them lives somewhere and has lamps and hats and teacups and things. They think of different things all the time, and I'll never find out what if I live 1,000 years. Can you imagine?
I suppose they do. At least sit up and drink with me, will you?
No. All right. To us, may we be young and beautiful forever, and live in hotels and be outrageously rich. I can't get used to the idea of being married. Nobody can tell us what to do anymore. Isn't that something? We're done growing up now. We're grown.
Must we always be very serious now that we're grown?
Oh, well, let's not.
Very well. To the Fitzgeralds.
I love you, Scott.
I love you, Zelda.
6. Scott began having extramarital affairs almost right away. Zelda may have had a few too, though she was more secretive about them if she did. One of Scott's affairs was with Eugenia Bankhead, actress Tallulah Bankhead's sister. The Bankheads grew up in Montgomery, Alabama with Zelda. We are now at the opening of an important show in a Broadway theater. It is January 1921. Scott and Zelda are arriving late. They bump the knees of invisible audience members in order to get to their seats.
Excuse me. Excuse me.
Pardon us there. Oh, I'm sorry, madam. Please excuse us. We're late. We're late, you see.
Which one is this anyway?
That dancing show? The one Jean recommended.
I thought that was last night. I remember because it was such a bore. Yoosh!
Well, it's not that one then. Let's have a look.
Did I ever tell you when Tallulah went off to New York to try to be a Follies girl? I said to Sarah and Zara, I said, everyone's so scandalized, but we always knew she could act. The audacious thing is really that she thinks she'll be in the Follies. With those legs, the only kind of Follies she'll get into are the marital kind.
You did tell me that one, yes.
I'm happy to admit I was wrong. It's such a rare occasion.
Yes, this calls for a drink.
He reaches into the top of Zelda's stocking to pull out a flask.
Brazen.
It's all right, we're married.
They both drink from the flask.
Oh, look, isn't that a Barrymore? This must be a very serious play anyhow.
What's he on about?
Something desperate.
Oh, what a tragedy. Why must everything be so difficult?
Oh, there, there, you poor thing. You're very affected by the theater. Always have been. Remember, we saw Hamlet and you were dyspeptic for months. Truly inconsolable. I don't know why you insist. Yoosh! I won't shh. Yoosh!
We are trying to enjoy the atmosphere, sir. We don't come to the theater to be shushed by the likes of you.
Oh, look, here's the funny fellow.
The funny one, he's here already, oh my.
Oh my!
Darling, the funny part is over now. We're back to the tragedy. The hopeless march of the weary man towards death. In the penultimate scene where we'll all be weeping. Oh, but it's sad already. We can weep already.
I simply can't.
Yeah, well, you've got to focus on the more tragic aspects.
Which ones?
No, I suppose we may have missed those, yes. We may have missed our opportunity for tragedy. They better just change it to a comedy now. There's nothing to be done for it. Someone ought to tell them. Oh, good, here comes an usher.
He'll want us to leave.
Is that all? My good man, are you asking us to vacate our seats for which we have paid hard-earned wages just because my wife here enjoyed the funny fellow?
Zelda laughs so hard she falls out of her seat.
I see your point, old sport.
Scott lifts Zelda. He executes an awkward bow before carrying her past the same row of people.
Oh, Lord.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've been the Fitzgeralds. Look for us in Vanity Fair, on the tops of New York taxi cabs, and among the heavenly bodies. Enjoy the show.
Zelda waves goodbye as Scott carries her off stage. 7. During Zelda's pregnancy, the Fitzgeralds toured Europe before visiting Montgomery, expecting to have the baby there, but couldn't bear the summer heat, and ended up in Scott's hometown, St. Paul, Minnesota. Zelda disliked pregnancy. She felt fat and sick. Their daughter is born in October 1921. Zelda is in a hospital bed. Scott sits by her side. They are looking down at the baby in Zelda's arms.
Patricia.
What?
Let's call her Patricia.
Don't be stupid.
It's a good name.
We've called her Scotty. Oh, Francis Scott. Did you forget? After our most famous relation.
Your most famous relation.
Yours too.
My pet.
No, it's Scotty. I think they gave you too much gas. You're goofy.
You're goofo.
Well.
Isn't she the most luminous thing you ever saw? She'd make your eyesight sharper, I swear. How can she be so little? How did you do that?
She's perfect.
Let's keep her. She's better than Christmas.
We must never quarrel again, Zelda. We must be happy and easy with each other always so that Scotty never has to suffer.
How do you mean?
Well, even if we aren't entirely happy with each other, we'll pretend, won't we? For her sake.
You won't fight with me anymore?
It's not my fault we argue.
Don't say not to fight and then start fighting.
I'm not.
You're impossible.
All right, all right. That was our last one.
Ever.
8. Scott's novels are his most famous legacy, but he was also a prolific short story writer, and that's mostly how he made his living. Zelda edited and inspired his work and wrote short stories of her own, which she sometimes published without any input from Scott. However, they were always published under a joint byline or Scott's name alone. It is September 1922, in the messy living room of a rented house in St. Paul, the day after a party. A typewriter sits on the coffee table. Zelda appears in the doorway. Groaning begins to emerge from behind the sofa.
Is that you?
Hmm?
Is that...
You saying something, Goofbo? I can't make you out. Hello? You dead, Scott?
Yes. Or almost.
He crawls out from behind the sofa.
Where's Scotty?
With a nanny.
I want to see her.
Oh, later. Oh, God. Zelda, I drank all the booze in Minnesota last night, perhaps the whole Midwest.
I'd noticed you'd got quite a slant on you. Don't you remember much?
Oh, I remember you weren't exactly straight either. Where'd you get off to, anyway? We were looking all over for you, but you'd run off or some damn thing.
I was taking a bath. It's freezing around here, and I wanted to try to warm my bones. Then I got so cozy, I thought I might sleep in here, but that awful nanny Annie came and yanked me out like a duckling and tucked me in with Scotty. Only when I woke, they were both gone, and everyone was gone, and you turned into a sofa.
I've got to write. I'm late. I'm very late.
Scott inserts a piece of paper into the typewriter and places his fingers on the keyboard. Zelda gets a notebook and pen and begins to write.
What is it? Why are you glaring at me? Go ahead and write.
Can't you keep it down? I'm working.
I'm being quiet.
Well, you're making a racket.
I'm sorry.
Just keep quiet.
I am.
What's that?
What's what?
That, what you're, what the hell are you doing?
I'm writing.
I'm writing. I am.
And so am I.
You can't you do that somewhere else?
I wanted to be here by the fire,
it's very distracting. What are you writing, anyway?
He gets up and peers over her shoulder at the notebook.
Nothing. I'll go.
She stands. He grabs her shoulder as she tries to exit.
Don't you see that this is important? I'm actually writing something and you're trying to ruin it. How will we live if I can't write?
You've had months to meet your deadline. You should have...
He slaps her.
How dare you?
I'm sorry. I didn't realize what I was saying.
You never do. You never think of anybody but yourself.
I'll go. I'll go.
She exits without her notebook. Scott picks it up, still angry. He reads it for a while, then sets it beside the typewriter. He begins transcribing what she's written. 9. The Fitzgeralds moved to Europe so that Scott could finish The Great Gatsby. They made friends with an artist's colony of mostly American expats along the Riviera in France. Zelda suffered from severe gynecological and abdominal ailments. Eventually, she had several operations, sometimes referred to as appendectomies, sometimes just surgeries. It's Rome, late 1924. Zelda lies curled in a ball on a hotel bed. Scott rubs her neck and back.
Poor Zelda. I'm afraid I make an awful nursemaid. I wish you hadn't done this, darling. It was almost perfect. Our European adventure on the deck of the mighty ship that would take us, the fairy tale couple, to the next place, the next party, the next whatever thing is better than the present, the next solution. You always want to be in the next place, or you're already gone, in fact. some of the time. You're too fast. Darling, you trip us up. I'll be watching you here in a moment with me, and we're chatting, and we're the best of friends, and you turn those luminous Indian eyes to me, and your mouth is smiling wider than the horizon, and I swell up with pride because I caused this. This moment is mine, and the whole world fills up with our expanded selves. And you're so miraculous that I can't remember which one of us is which. And in that breathless, mixed-up place, I realize I'm alone and you're gone. Your eyes go silver and flat, and all I have to show for our closeness is the whisper of something unsaid behind my lips. Shh, darling. Hush. Do you know what that is, Zelda? It's selfishness. It's not normal. At what point does a child become a person? What if it never becomes? Is it still a person? Was it, Zelda, was it simply because it was mine? You're not wild, not spontaneous, not mad like you pretend. You're selfish. You don't, in your iron heart, don't want me to follow you when you retreat into yourself. You like to leave me two steps behind you. You want me to feel like some stupid, conventional thing.
He realizes that Zelda has fallen asleep. He kisses her head. 10. In France, Scott became dependent on alcohol. Where he once could only write sober, he began to only write drunk. He partied at night, then drank and wrote all day. Zelda swam and began to paint. She was still very ill. She also became acquainted with Edouard Josin, the man who nearly ended her marriage. Now it's July 1926, midnight at a Parisian cocktail bar. Scott stands up on his crowded table, holding his glass, and addresses the room.
And now the famous Fitzies will tell their incredible story. Come, Zelda, climb up here.
Oh, all right then. Fine. You start.
It's the story of a straying wife.
A poor, neglected beauty.
Who caught the eye of a French airman.
On the beach, at the loneliest part of the Riviera.
And because her harried husband was so very engrossed in a novel.
In a bottle.
So she flirted like she'd been raised to do.
She'd flirted with an airman in the past.
An Alabama airman who plunged from the sky when she broke their engagement. She'd kissed him, and he thought it was certain. So when she broke it off, he was not only devastated, but also confounded. But why had she kissed him if she never intended to wed him? When he demanded to know the answer, she replied, as easy as you like,
I'd never kissed a man with a mustache before.
And ain't that how hussies do?
Don't plagiarize.
I'm quoting.
Oh, is that what it's called?
Then what?
The next day, his plane fell from the air over the Montgomery base, and he was killed.
Yes, but this French airman, this second airman, he's dashing and young.
As her now absent husband had been.
And she first began to swim with him.
Long, lazy laps in the azure sea.
And then later began to dance with him in the loud, brassy halls soldiers tend to frequent.
To fill the empty evenings while her husband caroused with other men.
And their bodies fit together so well.
And they took each other's heartbeats in.
And his hands became tangled in her golden curls.
And her lips began to smolder under his fervent desire.
They mistook lust for love.
She was hypnotized by his intense interest.
And in a moment of weakness, she confessed everything to her prying husband.
Who was gnarled inside by his jealousy.
She told him they had kissed and gone
but
even
nothing
beyond
more,
that.
Nothing more.
He was consumed by a furious passion.
He tore her dress and bruised her body.
He made love to her all night long.
No.
And in the cold morning light, drunk from lack of sleep, she admitted she no longer loved him.
She admitted he no longer loved her. She told him there was someone who cared for her. And would it not be better for everyone if he released her? Didn't he only love her when someone else wanted her? How could they go on?
But they had held each other up for so long that if either of them left, the other would collapse.
And perhaps she had already begun to collapse.
Instead, he forbade her to see the man ever again. In fact, he forbade her to see anyone. He locked her in her room.
And left her rotting in there for 20 days and 20 nights, like a princess in a tower.
During which time, he challenged the aviator to a duel.
Oh, did he now?
They met on an empty, sacred beach. The wind whipped harsh sand against their skin, his pale and work-weary, the aviator's tan from his many dallying hours in the sun. They faced each other and shook hands as if they were businessmen making some kind of back-alley deal, and they turned their backs and paced out the steps. When they were the correct distance apart, they turned and raised their arms. Both hands were steady as brick, but when it came time to fire, neither bullet struck home. They both lowered their pistols, both relieved and disappointed, neither sure what they truly wanted the outcome to have been. Wordlessly, they made their way back to their separate cars, started them up, and drove home in the same direction.
She never saw the aviator again, not even to say goodbye.
He fought the urge to lie and tell her she'd killed the man.
After the 20 days' penance, he released her, and she stepped into the harsh sunlight, blinking and grateful to him.
He could see she had changed. She had used the time to think of the destruction she had nearly caused.
She was silent and meek like a novice nun.
She said nothing to him.
She swam her long laps alone and no longer basked in the brilliance of the greenish sea. It now smelled rotten to her.
She allowed her husband to finish his work.
She began a little work of her own.
Hardly work.
A little work.
And they've tried to repair the damage she'd done.
She'd been driven to do.
And that was the second airman she refused.
Who needs an airman when you have a man who flies without a plane? Who treads the air with yellow boots?
So, that's our story, and you're lucky to have heard it tonight.
It might wear out from overuse at any time.
Now that you know our most intimate affairs, you owe us something. What shall we exact, Zelda?
A kiss! A kiss!
From whom?
From everyone.
Excellent. You now owe us a kiss. Now!
Scott and Zelda kneel on the table and give a quick kiss to each of the invisible drinkers. They both start with the upstage two drinkers, then Zelda goes right and Scott goes left halfway around the table. When they kiss the two downstage drinkers, they turn to each other, laughing, and give each other a long kiss.
The most beloved lips in history.
And the best used.
They kiss each other again.
I love you, Dodo, still.
I forgive you.
Am I sorry?
Aren't you?
Are you?
I love you too, anyway.
Can we go home now?
I'm happy.
I'm tired.
Oh, you go then.
Zelda gets down from the table.
Good night, all my shiny new French friends. I know you don't understand a word. Au revoir, bonne nuit.
Zelda, don't go.
Don't drink everything in this city, if you can help it. All right? I'll see you tomorrow, or when you're home.
She exits.
To my wife. Ain't she fun? Who's buying?
11. When Zelda was 15 years old, she was molested by two boys in Montgomery, Alabama. When he wanted to hurt her, Scott would use this fact against her. At this point in their marriage, they haven't had sex for at least a year, probably more. Here we see Zelda high on morphine in August of 1926. Scott is reading a letter and drinking straight out of a bottle of red wine. He is quite drunk.
So, she'd been interfered with. Zelda, or anyone really. I mean, who hasn't? Who honestly has, hand to God, hasn't? And so she danced around the fact like the ice was getting thin, and she didn't call attention to it, and she skated smoothly like she might die someday with nobody the wiser. Isn't that better for everyone? Because as soon as he discovers a broken down, common liar like himself, and like the other women everywhere who would rather move on with their lives than don sackcloth and roam the streets weeping until their faces freeze that way. So, you sort of pretend It was your idea after all. And you sort of bend your thoughts to reflect his own. So you maybe liked that rancid smell of cigarettes on his breath. And after all, you wanted him to whisper vile nothings in your ear and melt your neck with his hot, hot breath. So maybe you took his hand in the end, and maybe that way you can look him in the eye because you can't stop living so as never to see the fellow again. Maybe you recall he wasn't so tipsy, and nor were you. And you looked across the room at him, not like some hunted thing, but like a tall ship sailing toward the stars, and you gracefully galloped away together. And you spent no time or morning in the bath trying to scrub the incident from your weeping arms. And now you know, after all, that nothing is magical in this world unless we will it so. And from now on, you can do anything you like and break the day wide open with your merciless teeth. You can gather the sunbeams in your arms and load them onto the next willing mule that comes along. So, Scott, or anyone really, carved my name into a tree in tiny letters and promised he'd take over all the hardest things so I could be in relative peace. But promises are wetter than dopey eyes, and now it's my fault, my own idea, that I learned and grew that day. The hottest day I remember. 15 in the schoolyard. Late, late in the afternoon when all the flowers were rotting from the inside out and the monster trees mopped the pink out of the sky. And when I cried, I was supposed to cry a little, but not too much. And the sky reflected that, turning orange before blue. A little, but not too much, blood red. I could hear the bugs and little things running wild, tuning up for the night, and I tried to shut my ears to them and listen to my stuttering breath, but in the end, they won, and I floated out into the dull sky. And the next day, I smiled my wicked smile and met everybody's eye. It was the last of my fear and the first of my acquaintance with sadness.
Scott stands up and deliberately but unsteadily begins undressing until he is completely naked.
Well,
do you want to make love or something?
Not with you.
He exits. She looks after him for a long time, turns away, forgets about him, smiles. 12. In the mid-1920s, Scott was offered a job writing movie scripts. None were successful, but they were lucrative contracts. He also began an affair with a 17-year-old actress named Lois Morin. Zelda was kept at home. Scotty lived with Scott's parents and a nanny. This is Hollywood in March 1927. Zelda eats an orange, making disgusted faces with every bite. Scott is typing, but he hates what he's writing.
Oh, this is awful.
Is it?
Awful.
Do you want some orange?
No.
Neither do I.
She eats more.
I hate it. It's useless to try to write for the movies. Useless.
He tears out the page and crumples it up. He tosses it at Zelda and inserts a new one. Zelda smooths out the page and reads it.
Yes, this is awfully stupid.
How do you mean stupid?
It's just exactly the kind of thing you'd expect. A little mop-eyed starlet with no interesting features falls in love with some dissipated gentleman and serves only to revive his interest in himself. It's every movie ever made.
Every movie has a beautiful girl. What's wrong with that?
It's not a real sort of girl. It's the sort of girl... the sort of girl a fairy would dream up. Not real. Not threatening, but not interesting in the least.
I'm not a fairy.
Not you, of course. Perhaps you're just picking up their style of writing. It's rather feminine, don't you think?
That's not... you've only read one page.
It's the same on every page, I'm sure. Am I wrong?
Don't you have something to do with yourself?
I'm eating an orange. Taste of California, you know. Very ripe and healthy.
Tell me a story.
What story should I tell you?
Oh, the time we met. In Alabama. Tell me like you still love me, and I'll make it a movie.
The girl, the heroine, she's from an old creaky town, and she's the town darling, and when she grows up, she must decide between marrying an exotic fellow and making a career on the stage. She has an incredible talent for dance, and after a recital when she was 16-ish, a producer approached her about touring to New York. She was, of course, interested and felt she had a duty to earn a proper living just to prove that she could, so she agreed.
Hang on,
what
about the romance? This isn't what happened. Tell it the right way.
I'm giving you a plot all wrapped up tidy.
What do you mean?
It's a morality movie. You could show both paths of the girl. First, when she accepts the offer for the stage and has a wild time in the city, but she wastes away and her youth fades until she throws herself down a great marble staircase and leaves an adorable corpse. Then, you go back to that moment, the offer from the producer, and she chooses the lover instead, and she's happy enough, and she has a few very clean children, but she always yearns for something more, and on her deathbed, she tells her daughters that work is vital to women.
That's... In fact, that's quite a thought. The two paths of... the dual life of a society girl... No, the two paths of Miss... anyhow, what's the moral here? Should she work or should she marry?
The moral is that it's all rotten anyhow, so you mustn't waste time lamenting the past you didn't choose. You could have that written on a little placard at the end.
That's too much. But the rest, maybe you're onto something. You've given me a start, anyhow. Could you run out and fetch something to eat?
What about an orange?
Oh, whatever you think is best.
Zelda gets up and exits, leaving her half-eaten orange on the table. 13. Legend has it that one night in a Paris bar, Scott worried aloud to Ernest Hemingway about his fear of sexual inadequacy. Ernest pulled Scott into the bathroom for a literal dick-measuring contest. Let's rejoin the Fitzgeralds in their Delaware mansion in December 1928. Scott is seated against a wall of Zelda's makeshift dance studio, nursing a hangover. The March of the Toy Soldiers plays on a loop as Zelda practices a repetitive set of ballet exercises.
I can feel my heartbeat in my head.
So can I.
It's awful. Hang on. Does it mean you can feel your heartbeat or mine?
I'm not entirely sure. Somebody's...
Why must you do this to yourself every day?
I enjoy it.
It looks ghastly. It can't be healthy to do this for 12 hours every day. It's insane.
If I want to become a professional ballerina, I have to practice harder than every other dancer. I've started late, so I'm playing keep up with girls whose bodies are already better balanced than mine.
Nobody said you had to become a dancer.
I want to. I can feel all the threads of myself gathering and propelling me into the world. I'd been a recluse, and now it's like coming out of prison.
I don't think I understand. Ow. Oh, God. I think I might die today. I'm too old to drink so much. It's killed me.
Scotty and I will have a lovely funeral for you.
Yeah, you'd rather I died.
You're stupid.
You're stupid. You've become all muscular and thin. I've never been less attracted to you. You look like a man.
I'm surprised you don't admire that in me.
That isn't clever, Zelda. You're not clever at all.
I pity you, Scott. I really do.
You're disgusting.
Because I've sometimes thought of other women.
I don't want to talk about that.
You did last night.
What?
You don't remember going around to every guest at the party and asking them, were they a fairy? Or was their husband one? They all left in despair of you. You'd become obsessed.
I want to know. I don't need to know, but I'm curious. I'm curious about these things. I was raised in Catholic cloisters, and I never thought a man might think of another man that way. I don't think about it all the time. I don't walk into a room, just any room, and ask everyone, are you a fairy or aren't you? I'm sure I don't do that. I like to know. Sometimes you can tell. I could tell right away that Thornton was. He had that. I could tell. Right away. And of course I knew right away that Ernest wasn't. He isn't. I felt it the way I feel I'm not. I might think of these things from time to time, you know, but I'm not obsessed. I'm never obsessive about things the way you are. I'm never trying to tell it, you know, about myself. I know that I'm not. I know it. Just because I don't, or we don't, aren't meritly, I don't know. I'm not a fairy. I never wanted that. I think it's disgusting. I think it's disgusting that you wanting to go with other women. Disgusting. You might give up on me. Be celibate. Why must you always have romances? You say you live through your dancing, so live. Give up this insanity. Let things be as they must be. And never call me a fairy again. Do you hear me? Oh, that's nice. I'll just dance away like a debutante, and I'll scrap for stories to buy your stupid shoes that blacken your nails and make your legs look ropey and hideous. There's no need for the princess to speak. No need at all.
He rises with great difficulty, trying not to vomit. He takes a few steps towards the door, is overcome by nausea, and runs the last few steps to vomit into the hallway. Zelda finally stops dancing. He throws himself face down on the floor.
I don't suppose you're crying at all.
No.
He begins crying.
Well, this is useless.
Zelda steps over Scott's collapsed figure on her way out the door. Scott cries harder. 14. Zelda began seriously training as a ballerina too late in life to have a good chance at a career as a dancer. But she trained so obsessively that she was offered a place in a professional ballet company in Italy. There is no record of why she turned it down. This is later, in June 1930. It's Switzerland, and Zelda is strapped to her bed in Prangin's mental hospital. Scott stands over her.
They said you might not feel like seeing me. I insisted. I feel so guilty. You tried to do too much. You were slipping away from me so gradually that I couldn't see it happening until you collapsed. This is all, I simply can't imagine what is happening inside of you right now. How you came to this point. You were so wrapped up in your dancing. Then all that nonsense about being in love with your teacher. I thought you were trying to hurt me. I thought you were only pretending. Then it was too late. Couldn't you have told me in time to save you? Wasn't there a way to make me see? Is it rather like, I know this isn't right, but is it like becoming just obliterated with drink? There's a style of logic to it. I must take this shoe off and place it in a drawer, but that other one doesn't matter, and I might as well wear it to bed. It's a logic that doesn't match what happens in the rest of the world. But when you defy the rest of the world, who is in the wrong there? Are you simply in love with a sick image of yourself as a tortured artist? Is there anything I could have done? Anything? Your family blames me, of course. I haven't told them the extent. I didn't realize how. I've only told them you are convalescing here. They would worry themselves ill over you here by yourself. They don't trust me to take care of you, but I will. I'm writing enough to pay all the bills for the clinic, for Scotty's school, the travel, everything. Scotty misses you terribly. She would love for you to write to her. I wish I didn't love you. I could abandon you if I didn't care so damn much.
He leans over and kisses her. 15. The nature of Zelda's illness is still unknown. At the time, it was given as schizophrenia, but modern psychiatrists don't find much evidence for this. Some of Zelda's symptoms, such as falling in love with other women and not being fulfilled by her duties as a wife and mother, would no longer be considered signs of illness today. But this is May of 1931. Zelda and Scott sit side by side at the desk in the Swiss psychiatrist's office. Zelda has a weird smile that she can't control and some eczema, but otherwise seems healthy. They speak to the doctor.
I don't see why I can't be released.
You're not, she's not ready.
But this cure is killing me. I've never had eczema before I came.
So you have eczema. The ointment helps, and
it's not getting better.
Well, that's because you don't rest. You paint, you write, you obsess.
So I must give up everything I love?
You love me, don't you? We love each other.
But you won't see me or speak to me. You haven't touched me.
She fought with me constantly. How could I force myself to be attracted to someone who makes herself my enemy?
You drink too much. You became a beast and you fight with me. Won't you give it up?
I'm not going over this again. If I want a glass of wine at the end of the day, a long day by myself, struggling to pay the astronomical bills to keep her in the best care, who can deny me that? It's the only thing I have to look forward to. The one thing. It's foolish for me to have come here. I can see that now. It gives her hope of release.
I always hope for release. If I give up my hope of release, I'll be like all the other maniacs in here.
You are a maniac.
I'm not. You were all trying to make me one. You're making me crazy, but I'm not.
So what are you?
I don't know anymore. This cure is making me too confused. I can't see where I'm going anymore. But, I want to be going towards you. I want to go away with you and be married again.
I want that too. I want you well again.
I love you.
16. Soon after Zelda's release from her first mental institution, her father, Judge Sayre's health failed. Scott's father had died earlier that year while Zelda was in the hospital. They are in Montgomery visiting the judge's deathbed. It's November 1931.
Is he sleeping?
I think so. Doesn't he look so small? I've never seen him this way. I feel like he's my child. Did you feel that way when your father died?
No. It was sudden.
That might be better. This lingering is bad.
Do you think it'll be over soon?
It's hard to tell. His physician is nearly as ancient as he is. I can't put my full faith in a man whose hands shake.
Scott looks down to see his own hands. They shake. He hides them behind his back.
I hate to leave.
We'll get along without you. Though we'll miss you just awfully.
I'll miss you. I'm glad you'll be with family. When you need a nurse, I'll hire someone right away.
If I need one.
Yes. Or you can return to the clinic anytime. You know that, right? There's nothing wrong with returning.
If... He's stirring. Daddy?
Sir?
Daddy, are you all right? He's only shifting. Should we leave you?
I wanted to be sure and say farewell before I leave for Hollywood. I've got a screenplay commission for a lot of money. I'll be keeping Zelda in style.
Scott will be back before we know it, though. He just wanted you to wish him luck for while he's out there.
It would mean a great deal to me. You never really... Well, it doesn't matter, but you never truly gave me your blessing, and I would very much appreciate having it now. I know you haven't always approved of me, but now that you've come to know me, don't you? Approve, I mean? I've never let your daughter suffer any more than I could possibly help. I've given you a fine granddaughter. My books are... Well, could you give me your blessing now? Do you think?
The judge says something too soft for Scott to hear. Zelda leans over him.
What was that, Daddy?
He repeats himself. She nods.
What did he say?
Daddy, we're going to leave you alone to rest up now. Say goodbye, Scott.
Goodbye, sir. I hope you're feeling better next time I see you.
Sleep well, Daddy. We love you.
Scott and Zelda leave the room.
Well, what did he say?
It wasn't the blessing you wanted.
I wasn't expecting the blessing I wanted. He's a man of iron, and I can never seem to find a joint in him.
He said he knows you'll always pay the bills.
Right.
That truly frets him.
You're right. It was easier with my father.
Do you miss him?
I hardly ever saw him when he was alive. But there's something empty in knowing that he's gone.
You understood each other.
We were more alike than I care to admit.
I never understood the judge. I don't even really understand Minnie. It's no wonder I'm so adrift.
You're much better now.
I will always be measuring myself against a fixed mark of normalcy that wasn't set by me.
I better collect my things for the train.
17. Scott had 5 novels published. Zelda only published 1, the semi-autobiographical Save Me the Waltz. It deals with similar material to Scott's Tender is the Night, that material being Zelda's nervous breakdown. This is March 1932. Scott is visiting Zelda in a mental hospital in Baltimore. He is holding her unpublished manuscript and a pen.
You think you've written a book?
I have written one, and Max likes it. Oh God, he likes it! He thinks it can be published!
Why didn't you show it to me? Why did you show it to my editor and not me? What were you thinking?
I didn't want to bother you with it.
How could you do this to me, Zelda?
What does my book have to do with you?
You know I've been struggling. It's been 8 years. I've been suffering to write this novel. It's killing me. You've watched me breaking myself over it, and then you go and write your own version in 3 months? Just to torment me.
I did it to survive. I hate it here. This clinic is worse than Switzerland, much worse. I needed to do something, so I wrote my life story.
So you took my novel and perverted it?
It's not your novel.
Oh, yes, it is. You can't pretend you made this up. I read you my draft when we were in Florida. I read you... Snake, you've stolen...
It's nothing like your draft.
It's exactly like mine, except shoddily done.
Max likes it. He wants to publish it.
You sent it to my editor instead of me because you're too cowardly to own up to the theft.
It's no theft.
You have to make some serious changes, Zelda. This section where they meet has to go. This part, this story is out, this whole middle section.
I can't change it.
You'll have to revise the entire thing. What were you thinking?
I won't change it unless I feel a strong aesthetic compulsion.
This gets revised or cut. This...
It's my story.
It's our story, and I'm the one writing it. You can't write the same story.
It's my story. It's my story. It's my story. It happened to me.
This is out. This.
It's mine.
This, I'll have to cable Max in the morning. All of this. This chapter. This.
18. Scotty Fitzgerald lived to be 64. She worked as a writer and journalist and had 4 children. Now she is 15 and visiting with her parents at a short-term rental apartment in Asheville, North Carolina. It's August 1936.
Thank you both for coming to visit me.
Your mother just adores her new hospital.
It's much better here. Much better. It's good to see you. It feels like ages.
We're so proud you got into Ethel Walker.
We are! We're so very proud of our little girl. Or, well, you've grown too big for that now.
You're the most important thing, Scotty.
To both of us.
We just want you to avoid the mistakes that we made.
We want you to be happy.
And healthy.
And free to do as you like.
But cautious and careful.
Don't let anybody tell you what to do.
Take this time to decide what you want to do with your life. You're 15, almost grown.
And... pursue your passion zealously. Don't let anything steer you off course.
No, leave time for friendships and romance later. Romance is for later in your life. But don't shutter your heart.
Always have a way to support yourself. You'll regret it if you don't.
And of course.
For God's sake.
Stay away from liquor.
Stay away from liquor.
Don't become dissipated.
You could ruin yourself.
Be better than your parents.
Be much wiser and happier and healthier.
It's the task of every child to surpass their parents.
And outlive them.
Oh, yes. Scotty, you must promise to outlive us.
Promise us that.
If nothing else.
19. Zelda's final clinic was in Asheville, and it was called Highlands. She and Scott lived apart for the latter half of their marriage. When she wasn't at Highlands, Zelda lived with her mother. She took up painting again and became very good at it. Good enough that the clinic commissioned some paintings from her. Right now, she is painting an abstract red flower on a large canvas. It's 1938. She is speaking to a nurse.
A little more crimson. There. It doesn't seem right to display my work for just lunatics, but... people aren't fearful when I paint. They think it's therapeutic. No matter how deranged the subject is. I've always loved flowers. I'm not a great painter. If I were one, I would want to be Georgia O'Keeffe. Instead, I'm someone unstable. Nobody knows what to do with me. I'm glad they let me paint. In Switzerland, I wasn't always allowed. Of course, my skin felt as though it were burning up and peeling right off of me. It's no wonder I was out of my head half the time there. They gave me all these terrible piqûres and I would lose sense of myself. Then I was at that expensive place in New York with all the tennis and gold I could ever want. In the end, it was so dear. Well, and then there was Baltimore, and I thought it might be better to die than to, well, never mind. I like it here. I'm glad I'm here. It's the only place that's made me feel even a little steady. I miss everybody, though. Scott and Scotty. Dancing, France. I miss living.
20. While Zelda was in and out of Highlands, Scott was in and out of Hollywood, once again trying to sell movie scripts. He began living with journalist Sheila Graham, and their relationship lasted until his death. Here's Scott in 1938, standing by the pool at his apartment. Sheila is swimming her daily laps.
You going to swim another lap? I've got to write at least 500 more words today. I feel so useless. I'm trying to find water in a well that's been dry for half a lifetime now. I keep picking up my manuscript and loathing myself so violently I have to cast it aside. They've lost faith in me. They don't think I'll finish it. And they're probably right. At this rate, I might have to break with them. I think... anyway, I can't join you. When you come out, we could, I don't know, I feel completely wasted away. I've let down everybody in my life, and now I'm an empty shell hacking up trite comedies that everybody pretends to take seriously. Even you. Because you're sweet, Sheila, you're a sweet girl. You're a liar, a sweet liar. All women are liars, and men, and we're all frauds in the end. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm in the shadows today. Can't seem to get started. Hardly seems worth it. I'm ruining your swim. I'll leave you. I don't know what you see in me. Whatever it is, keep seeing it, all right?
21. When Scott died, Zelda was unable to attend the funeral. They hadn't seen each other for almost a year. This is their final meeting in April 1939. Zelda is waiting with their luggage in a New York City airport, having just returned from Cuba. Scott enters, sick from drink, with a black eye and a bad cough.
I've got a cabbie to take you to the hospital. He's outside. He can take you there. I've paid him. Tildy will come see you. She'll take care of everything from here. Nobody will know. I'll make sure nobody finds out. Your poor eye. God, you look terrible.
Where will you be?
I'm taking the train back to Highlands. Dr. Carroll will collect me, or a nurse.
I'm sorry about everything.
What in particular? Which part of this disaster are you apologizing for? Not sending the money in time for me to visit Cuba with the other maniacs?
I took you myself, didn't I?
You showed up drunk at the airport. You couldn't control yourself for even a week. You're... Look at yourself. You're ruined.
I didn't mean to. Only I'd argued with...
Don't say her name.
I'm...
You drank and brawled your way through Havana. You're absolutely putrid. So goddamn putrid that you couldn't even get us out of there, and you left it up to me, who's penniless and crazy, to book the tickets back? How could you?
Let's not leave in tears.
Right. Feel better, Gufo.
Which bag is mine?
Zelda lifts the heavier bag and gives it to him. They look at each other for a long moment, then Zelda lifts her own bag and gives Scott a peck on the cheek. Epilogue, 1940. An excerpt from a real letter that Zelda wrote to Scott.
Dearest, I am always grateful for all the loyalties you gave me, and I am always loyal to the concepts that held us together so long. The belief that life is tragic, that a man's spiritual reward is the keeping of his faith, that we shouldn't hurt each other. And I love always your fine writing talent, your tolerance and generosity, and all your happy endowments. Nothing could have survived our life. Devotedly and always with my deepest gratitude, Zelda.
F. Scott Fitzgerald died in 1940 at the age of 44 of heart failure, probably due to his alcoholism. Zelda Sayre Fitzgerald died in 1948 at the age of 47 in a fire at the Highlands Clinic. End of play.
Thank you for joining us for Zelda and Scott by Bethy Fowler. We'd like to thank the cast, the audience, and especially The Tank, an incubator for emerging artists in New York City, for their generous donation of space. You can learn more about The Tank at thetanknyc.org. And if you'd like to support Elephant Run District, our podcast, and the rest of our exciting programming, please donate at elephantrundistrict.org. You can find the link on this page. It's through generous donations like yours that we can keep bringing you the most exciting, independent, and newly developed plays. We hope you return for our next play, Hello from the Children of Planet Earth by Don Nguyen. Thanks for listening. Until next time.